saw and recognized a deeper truth.
Let's go back.
Only one way to test the faith, and that was on your knees. And I said, please send me a sign, any kind of a sign, just something to give me an indication of genuineness. He kept at that for a while, and then he said it was like suddenly the floodgates opened everywhere he looked. He got answers.
Sounds like his dad.
No, let's stop. In some ways, yeah, he's much like his father in a lot of ways. A stiffer version.
How long was this?
That is such a phony line if you analyze it. But if it goes by in a movie, you know.
What's a phony line?
The way Eric goes,
Yeah, I know. It's bullshit. He sounds, he's a stiffer version of his father. But what were you going to say?
When was this made?
2004, 2005. Mm. Dated 2005. But there was, I was going to say.
Well, you met Eric, right, Scott?
Well, yeah, I know, but I
can you give the year of that? Because it looks like he went to New Zealand on that trip. Because I met Scott Eastham, Andrew Crystal's thing, said that Eric came to New Zealand around 2000. So were you married when you met Eric?
I only met him for a second.
Scott. Yeah, you guys went to the church.
But I met him the next day when he was leaving. I just shook his hand for a second. I said,
did you hear him speak?
I said something like,
you said Bob.
Blah, blah, blah. And he goes, well, Bob Dobbs thinks that.
Which was interesting you evoked that. I didn't know that he knew. I didn't know that he knew what I said.
Right.
But did you hear him speak?
No.
So Scott
went with somebody.
Now, when was that, Scott?
John Snyder.
Well, it had to be before you moved up. When did you move up to Portland?
2000.
Not 2001. 2000. So it was near the end, right? So it was 99 or 2000, which is about the time that he went to New Zealand.
Yeah, it's probably the same thing.
Okay, so because, you know, he would be hopping across.
He got answers.
Once he accepted Catholicism.
Oh, that's what I wanted to say. He got answers?
Yeah.
An art critic comes. They tell this art critic story in this movie, right? The French art, Derek tells it, but there was this French art critic, maybe it was that guy, came in 78 or so, and McLuhan said, okay, well, he would be, quote, the jest of honor, and Marshall says, well, we have this French art critic, very important person. So, Pierre, has there been any art development since 1917? And the fucking guy looked at McLuhan like he was a fucking nut. You understand what McLuhan was saying? Yeah. There hasn't been anything since 1917, he'd say. This guy was living in the 60s and 70s if it's all happening. But McLuhan was being consistent. No art possible after 1922. But he writes about that. McLuhan says later, like this critic, hold your thought, this critic says, he says, eventually, throughout the evening, he says, I just don't see anything has any meaning anymore. And McLuhan says, oh, I find meaning everywhere. That's the same statement as that, finding answers everywhere. Okay.
No art after 22 because art, conventional art, could not become an anti-environment to the electric environment.
Right, radio took over. And, you know, that's when The Wasteland came out, and Pound started his cantos shortly after that, and Joyce published Ulysses, and Lewis was working on his stuff. That they were confronting this fact, the death of art.
Picasso and Einstein had already come and gone?
Picasso was peaking about that period. And Einstein, yes, a theory of general relativity was 1915 or so, or 1917. Yeah, they'd happened. Okay, so Jerry, we can go. Just rewind slightly.
Suddenly the floodgates opened everywhere he looked. He got answers.
Once he accepted Catholicism, and this tied into his relationship with G.K. Chesterton, and saw and recognized a deeper truth than that which he had had as a kid, he latched onto that with the zeal that conversions to causes, or people that are converted to causes, seem to have alone, and that is a certitude that comes from that sort of revelation that this is right, that can propel them through life.
Marshall would spend his career as a teacher primarily or almost exclusively at Catholic institutions. This began in 1937 with his acceptance of a position in the English department at St. Louis University. In 1944, he moved to Assumption College in Windsor, Ontario. And in the autumn of 1946, he landed in the English department at St. Michael's College, where he would teach the remainder of his career.
Now, that's a famous picture of McLuhan walking with Don Thiel.
Is it?
Yeah, Don Thiel gave that to me years ago. He found it in his files. I think it was printed in the local U of T newspaper at the time. And you see, you don't see it here, but Don, this would be maybe 1955 or so. He has white bucks on. You know, the kind of stuff that guys wore back then. White bucks. Anyways, that's Don Thiel and Marshall.
Hmm.
They were kind of known as the duo, you know, hanging out. They were the team. So let's go back a bit.
Where?
Don was the only person I ever saw McLuhan with Harold Innes. Witnessed them talking.
Oh, really?
Most people think they never met, or very little interchange.
In the autumn of 1946, he landed in the English department at St. Michael's College, where he would teach the remainder of his career. Both Assumption and St. Mike's were colleges run by the Basilian Fathers.
Can you just go back again, which would hold slightly just before the Don Thiel? Okay.
In college in Windsor, Ontario. And in the autumn of 1946, he landed in the English department at St. Michael's College, where he would teach the remainder of his career. Both Assumption and St. Mike's were colleges run by the Basilian Fathers, an order which would hold a significant role throughout McLuhan's life.
They were both converts. My mother converted a few years after, I think after they were married. Not long.
You should know that in the event of a mixed marriage, a non-Catholic is obliged to receive a certain minimum of instruction about the church and to agree that the children, if any, should be reared as Catholics. It strikes me as a colossal gamble, or rather a very great adventure. And personally, I am considerably exhilarated by the risks. The greatness of the adventure perhaps consists partly in the fact that as a Catholic, I can only marry once. Dearest Mother, what a rush. The whole thing was quite at the last minute. Corinne decided to go home Thursday a.m. and decided to get married here on Friday the 4th, on Thursday afternoon. You can imagine our frantic rushings around for license, ring, dispensation, steamship reservations, passport for Corinne, to say nothing of the wedding itself.
Stop. See, McLuhan was going to Cambridge to work on his thesis. And she wasn't agreeing to get married. And they said, okay, well, if you say no, that's it. So I'm heading out like in a couple of days. So she said, okay, I'm going home. And then later in the day, she decided, nah, I'm going to hang out with him. So they ran around, they had to get her passport and everything before he left. You know, and he'd already got it all organized. But now they had to quickly get everything because he was scheduled to go in a few days. So they go to Italy or something and they travel through Europe for a month. Then they arrive in Paris the day before World War II breaks up. So anyway, just a little back
then. And what date did Finnegan's Wake come out in 39?
3 months earlier. May. Publicly came out May 39.
Was he already getting it then?
There's a story that he, you know, I think it's in one of the biographies that he and Bernard Muller, Tim, had a copy of Finnegan's Wake, you know, very quickly, and were looking at it in a tavern.
Right.
And maybe some people in the tavern wondering what it was. But that would have to be when he came back in 1940, summer of 40. Unless they were looking at it immediately, you know, in May, June, before he takes off in August.
You don't think it would be immediately?
I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know. I don't know when but it was very quickly. The story, I think in the story, in the Bible, as soon as he came out. But technically, he was looking at it with Muller Tim, and if that happened before he went away, then it had to be then, or it would have happened after.
He wasn't reading it all those years it was coming out as installments in the magazine?
He might have been, because he seemed to know about it. And the Evergreens told me, or he told me through the Evergreens, he understood, he started to figure out Finney's Wake in 37. So he seems to, if you believe the spirit, was aware of it before it came out. Because you could, Yeah, they discuss the book in the 30s. He says they discuss it in the courses in the schools in Cambridge, and that would be between 34 and 36, and that was in transition and all that. So,
what,
you know, the magazine transition.
When did Joyce
die? He died a year and a half later, you know, January 41.
So Marshall would have never got to meet him.
Right.
Marshall could only meet him secondhand through you.
That's right. Now, here's the synchronicity. On the day that Hitler, invades Poland, whatever he did, on September 1st, England, I think, declares war on the 3rd. But on September 1st, he's in Paris, they're on their honeymoon, in the hotel, he hears on the radio, whatever, in the morning, whenever, that the invasion has happened. So he immediately gets Corinne, they pack up, and they head to the coast. They got to get to England. And they get to England, they get to the coast, and that same day, Wyndham Lewis is on a boat going down the English Channel, going right in front of McLuhan.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That's a few miles away. And that same day, James Joyce is up there nearby where McLuhan's getting a boat to England, sitting in a home, sanitarium or whatever, babysitting his diseased daughter. So the three of them form a triangle on the outbreak of World War II, right in the same area. One guy's on the water, two guys are on the land. So from God's point of view, if there is a God, you know, he's looking, he's saying, I got this fucking guy, he's sitting beside, he's going to use the guy in the water, Lewis, to understand the guy who's looking after his daughter, Joyce, right? A little triangle right there. I'm the only one who ever pointed that out. I researched it and got the date, the positioning.
Was that 11 a.m.?
Let's stop. Now, Lewis, Lewis's biography, he was scheduled to get on a boat a few days before. I think his wife didn't like the boat or was a problem, so they didn't get on it. So they get on the next day's boat. And the passage of these boats to avoid the subs was up into the Arctic ice floes, you know, Greenland or whatever, and head down to New York City. The boat that Lewis didn't get on sank. Everybody drowned.
To say nothing of the wedding itself.
You want to go back?
It was at 11 a.m.
She looks, to me in that picture, she looks nuts. She's a manic in
license,
her eyes.
Ring, dispensation.
I think she's confused by
him. Passport.
She's confused by him.
To say nothing of the wedding itself. It was at 11 a.m.
Okay,
in
stop.
The cathedral.
If that's love, it shows you the mania of love, if you take that photograph as showing some kind of reality. Doesn't she look like fucking whacked?
It's just a moment in time, though.
Yeah, it's just a little moment. This could be the reflection light, but the effect of it is that she looks wild-eyed.
To say nothing of the wedding itself, it was at 11 a.m. in the cathedral
that's
rectory.
That's right. Stop. They're running around getting the passports, the fucking everything, and they're going to get married. And they haven't told their parents. And her parents, you know, were pretty strict, apparently. They didn't want her to marry a Catholic. They were Southern Baptist. Now, Jerry, don't fall asleep. Sit up straight. You're too comfortable.
No, I can't. When my body wants to start falling asleep, I'm going to.
So, well, we'll just keep waking you up to turn and rewind
it.
That's all right. So rewind just slightly, just to get the...
Married by Father Passport for Corinne. To say nothing of the wedding itself. It was at 11 a.m. in the cathedral rectory. We were married by Father Helmsing, a fine young priest. Must write Dad a note now. He hasn't heard yet. Everything is terribly confused. But
stop. You see? He's got to write one letter to his mother and one letter to his father somewhere else.
Faith himself. Must write Dad a note now. He hasn't heard yet. Everything is terribly confused, but all will straighten itself out before long. By signaling time, anyhow. You can imagine how little able I am to compose letters at present. Most loving, like Marshall.
There's Michael. This is Stephanie's documentary. This is an excerpt from... Well, I shouldn't say Stephanie. This is from that article, the film in 67, Telescope, the Canadian CBC one at the height of his Canadian fame, where she says, well, what's he like? They go, what's Marsh like? I don't know. What's he like? That's what she says to the camera. That's Michael there. That is Mary, I think.
Yes.
The one that me and Nelson work with. Marshall's having his beer. So if that's 1967, he's about 15.
Yeah.
This is home life. Go back. A great deal.
Watch him. That's do a that sluggy thing that his mom watches.
He values his home life a great deal. He's like a homing pigeon. The minute he goes away, the only thing he thinks about is coming back to the couch and a great big roaring fire.
Marshall and Corinne would have 6 children, 4 girls and 2 boys.
Well, his priorities really were his faith, number one, number two, his work, and number three
Let's stop.
Was his family.
He's a dupe, Marshawn. He's a Catholic himself. He was a student of Marshall in the 60s at St. Mike's, so I can assume he's a Catholic if he went to St. Mike's. So he's into promoting the Catholic angle.
So,
you know, you could say the Catholic thing is the most important thing in his life.
You want to stop it?
You can say the Catholic thing is the most important thing in his life, but to understand McLuhan deeply, he's saying the present situation really questions the whole ability to be a Catholic. That's what he says. You can't be a Catholic, which is based on the alphabet, under electric conditions.
Okay. I think it's weird. This guy says he puts his family in third place.
Home life.
Is that what he said?
Number one was his faith, number two is his work, and number three is his family.
When did he say that?
Just now. Put it back.
It's just before. Yeah, and you notice Michael makes a gesture. I know he says it, but I don't hear it.
Mom.
Makes a gesture. His mother said, like, she's leaning back saying, hey, don't eat in front of the camera,
yeah,
maybe. And he goes, fuck you.
Fuck you, yeah.
Just go back to that so Scott can see it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I noticed.
He values his home.
Oh, you can hear what she says.
He's like a homing pigeon.
You can hear. Look, Mark, listen to what Corinne, you can make out.
He values
your mommy. You just get that.
He values his home.
Give a little bite to mommy.
He's like a homing pigeon.
Go back, try it again. See if you can make it
work. Gestures like he's going to backhand her.
Yeah. What is she saying?
He values his home life a great deal. He's like a homing pigeon. The minute he goes away, the only thing he thinks about is coming back.
Mary was a babe. I'm surprised to hear she turned.
A great big roaring fire.
He says, I'll get that. She says he yearned to get back home into his couch where he'd get back and just lie there and ignore the family and read his poetry. Okay, what?
No, I was just surprised.
Mary,
she became like homeless or whatever.
Well, she got married and biced around. She was married.
When you knew her, was she a fox?
Oh, I met her in 77 coming here on the plane that the Flo and Eddie were on, right? September 30th, 1977. I went to a Captain Beefheart gallery showing and with Worcester. And there was another artist. It was Beefheart and someone else right up in Westwood. And we're just walking around looking at the art for a while. Beefheart wasn't there. And then Worcester comes up to me. He says, Bob, I have someone to introduce to you. You're going to be surprised, Bob, something like that. So he takes me over and he introduces me to Mary McLuhan. So that he had just been hanging around, he's social, and he got talking to this woman, and then synchronistically, it was Mary McLuhan, who was a good friend of the female woman, who was a friend of Beefheart, who was showing her art with Beefheart. So then I got to talk to the artist woman, Mary's friend, and she told me, I think I heard around then that she and Beefheart shared the same goat's milk distributor. Beefheart was into goat's milk, getting a certain kind of pure organic goat or something, a milk. So that was right when I was getting ready to go up and see Beefheart. So that's how I met Mary. So I talked to her that night, and she drove us home, and we talked out, and she got all excited about me. And then she went back down to her home in Laguna Beach, and she wanted me and Carolyn to come down there. But she was frantic about a whole bunch of shit because she'd been divorced for a few years before or recently and was pretty fucked up about the alimony or something. She had a whole distracting thing. And we were talking about the gallery thing. And I said, driving around in a car in Los Angeles or somewheres, anywheres, is more of a museum experience than anything you're going to get in a gallery. And she knew enough about Marshall's work. She said, wow, that's amazing. That's something my father would say. You're fucking neat, blah, blah, blah. So she got right into me because I was someone who understood what she thought her father was saying. So So we that was we never went down to her place. It never happened. I would hear about her a little bit through Eric or other details, and then she met Nelson 10 years later, and then Nelson reintroduced us, and then we started doing her doing consulting for her. Because she had formed the Marsh McLuhan Center of Global Communication. No, Jerry, we're going to keep you awake by it.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you do it then. There's play, there's pause. And the one next to play, you just touch it if you want to go back a second. Sorry, we'll hang on.
Well, we've told you a lot so far.
Oh, it's looking. We got the 10-minute point. It's pretty good, man. Hours to get 10 minutes.
Well, we had lots of interruptions. Yeah,
but somehow you got to get up at 4:30. We got to ask someone to call or...
Well, I ain't going to go to sleep.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, wait, you can't go to sleep. You know, I don't know how we're going to... We're going to wake you up later and you're going to sit up with me and we're going to watch movies. You're not going to bed, Jerry. You can sleep half an hour or something, but... We got all kinds of shit to watch, okay? Yeah. We're going to wake you up. You're going to have to get along. No.
We got two beef hearts and a Wild Man Fisher and a Bruce Bickford.
Yeah. So we'll be making you uncomfortable every now and then. Did you tape all that part?
No. Yep.
All that, what we just did?
Yep.
Good, good. So can you just rewind it, see where we're at?
You got to put it in play now.
Right, five.
And then hit. Yeah, now he'll play again.
Well, the way the only thing he thinks about is coming back to the couch and a great big roaring fire.
Marshall and Corinne would have 6 children, 4 girls and 2 boys.
Well, his priorities really were his faith, number one, number two, his work, and number three was his family.
Of course, I grew up in a house in which my father and mother had a very strong faith. They insisted naturally that we all go to Mass together as a family every weekend, every Sunday. I remember saying the rosary every night when I was young. We said it as a family.
He used to get up quite early in the morning, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and he would read the New Testament. And for variation, he would read, say, a Greek-English translation or a German-English translation.
You know, you're talking about him doing performance art. Robert Anton Wilson, in a book I was reading recently, where he was talking about, you know, brainwashing methods. He went through a whole assortment from Manson to what happened down in Kenya James Jones, or whatever his name was.
Jim Jones.
He said, you know, if somebody is, might be sort of repeating
rosary.
Like they get kidnapped and they sort of repeat the kidnappers' propaganda just to placate them so they don't get killed or whatever. He said after they repeat it for like more than 2 weeks or whatever, they just start believing it because they're reprogramming their subconscious. So Marshall, I don't know how he could not identify with being a Catholic if he was being a Catholic that much.
Right, no, he was a Catholic, but he was a questioning Catholic he does write, he does say in a note I saw in his archives, I identify with the underdogs, French-Canadian Catholics, French-Canadians, South, the American South, and the, something else. And, now, I don't know if it was French-Canadian Catholics or French, just French-Canadians, but, I took it as Catholics.
Spanish or Italian French.
He would go around the campus and complain to the priests. They had no fucking clue what was going on. No normal fucking Catholic is going to fucking argue with the priests. Maybe if you were a professor of theology and wouldn't have to be a priest maybe, but professor of theology, you might say our theology needs to be upgraded or whatever theologians do or there's reform movements. But he wasn't a professor of theology, technically. He was a layman at a church, at a college run by priests. He was overstepping the bounds of respect or something, or authority. And they all thought he was whacked, supposedly. They thought his interpretations of Thomism was erroneous. So what kind of Catholic is that? Mm-hmm. And he did say he had to infiltrate decent society, So he infiltrated as an underdog, in the underdog in relation to the establishment. But he seemed to be some kind of anti-environment. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a Catholic, but if you think he's a Catholic, oh, he just accepted dogma, or I don't know. He wasn't that kind of Catholic. He was like a saint questioning the whole thing. He might be made a saint in a couple hundred years if there's still a Catholic Church because of what he, more and more people realize the importance of what he's saying. He was warning the whole fucking church that you can't survive under these conditions. What are you going to do?
I heard this guy the other day on the Coast to Coast shows. I think Ian Punnett was the host. And he was talking about different states of nirvana that you can reach in Buddhism. It was actually pretty far out how expanded the mind can become in terms of nested levels of realization and ecstasy. And this guy was talking about, but the point I want to make is that I'll bet if there's any authenticity to Catholicism at all, those rituals must precipitate people into these higher states of consciousness, these nirvanas and stuff like that. They must be designed to do that on some level.
Yeah.
And if he went to Mass every day, then he was getting his acid hit from doing that.
Yeah. But
he really wasn't.
But it's only today would someone say he's getting his acid hit.
Right.
Due to television, which was an ecstatic-inducing medium, ecstasy-inducing medium, that made people want to continue it by taking drugs. So the whole culture goes drug-like. And McLuhan said, you can understand why people got into drugs and got into shamanism and took that as a religious thing. There's a whole different attitude in the 70s and 80s in relation to interpreting what's happening to the mass. Definitely in the 30s and 20s or 100 years ago, they never said, hey, man, that guy, G.K. Chesterton, goes to Mass every day because it's an acid hit. So look at what you're just saying there, what that indicates, a change of sensibility. I mean, it's almost like people now say drugs is the highest form of religious ecstasy. The non-drug cultures have one step down, right?
Yeah. Everybody I've ever heard who talks about having reached these higher states of consciousness through meditation or contemplation say that drugs are really take the back seat. Because even though they can precipitate you into glimpses of these higher states of consciousness, they also put filters on your brain which make the whole experience slightly inauthentic.
It's not what the Evergreens say about mescaline. The Evergreens recommended taking mescaline, I think it was mescaline, psilocybin, once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Not LSD, because LSD is an artificial thing and just repeats the experience. But mescaline is organic or alive or something, and it will trigger what you've done in the past year or make you realize something about it. And so once a year, you take this living thing that talks with you and talks back to you about what you've done the past year.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So, you distinguish between synthetic drugs and artificial drugs, but you probably think drugs are better than nirvana, because you said McLuhan did it as an acid hit.
I said it offhanded.
So okay, we won't hold you that. Look at that, the left hand, bottom 22 to 36.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so just go back a bit.
He would read, say, a Greek-English translation, or a German-English translation, or Spanish, or Italian, or French.
He really was a man who was wrapped up in his work. I think he felt that was genuinely his vocation. And it was his vocation.
Yeah,
it was the thing he was born to do.
Who's the guy on the right?
Hubert Humphrey.
Hubert Humphrey, yeah.
And that's right. Like
he carried an intuitive sense of the world, which...
That's Hubert Humphrey, and Ted Kennedy got mad. Ted Carpenter got mad at McLuhan being seen hanging out, photographed in public with Humphrey. Carpenter was very angry at Hubert Humphrey, who ran against Nixon in 68, and that was probably around 68, when Hubert Humphrey was a big figure in the media. Let me just go back a bit.
Manifested.
Or Spanish, or Italian, or French.
He really was a man who was wrapped up in his work. I think he felt that was genuinely his vocation. And it was his vocation. It was the thing he was born to do. He
carried an intuitive sense of the world, which manifested itself both in his study of media and in his reflections on his faith. The two would blend, quietly, indirectly, but clearly. In his study of media, he would put forward the perception that our society was built on the effects of visual media, print-based, beginning with the phonetic alphabet.
That's a ridiculous statement.
He would in turn...
Our society is built on the effects of visual media. Now, who knows what they mean by visual, but in McLuhan terms, the alphabet, which creates visual space, is very important to the Catholic situation, or at least it's built on it. McLuhan used to say, since most of the world is not affected by the alphabet, yet the Catholic Church propagates via the alphabet, he said, shouldn't we maybe move to another medium? Because we can reach more people in the world if we don't limit ourselves to the alphabetic medium.
Right.
So that was a question he raised to the Church. And to say visual media, you could say, okay, this guy, as a Catholic propagandist, say, only visual media affected us, which implies visual space or the alphabet or the Catholic medium. But that's a silly statement, another lazy statement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All media affect us, not just visual. Why would he say that? So just
you've said the Catholic Church relies.
Yeah, he's embedding and saying it's the only one that affects us, you know? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It could be propagated and embedded.
If there's haste, beginning with the phonetic alphabet.
No. See, beginning with the phonetic alphabet. So here, there's the confusion. This guy has not read the questioning of the whole alphabet. He's just celebrating the fact it's built on the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah, but we didn't have Catholicism before the phonetic alphabet.
Right, we couldn't have. And McLuhan is saying, they won't bring up this complex issue, that maybe the Church should not build itself on the phonetic alphabet. So if McLuhan's saying imagination is that faculty or ability that's not embedded in any media, then to be a real Christian, you're not embedded and dependent on the alphabet. You're not dependent on any other medium.
So therefore, you can't really propagate yourself as being anything.
That's right. And then that's tactility, which is nothing, interplay of senses around a foundation of nothing, and television is a nothing medium. A lot of questions and intricacies and complexities come out of that point. So that's what he was saying in that quote there, that the Christian, true Christian, merges medium and message, and it affects their living. Okay, so just can you go back?
Who's that guy on the left?
I don't know who those people are.
That would be in the 70s.
You'll go back. It's probably some conference. Just some conference somewhere.
Manifested itself both in his study of media and in his reflections on his faith. The two would blend, quietly, indirectly, but clearly.
I like that. I mean, you think about when the media become a seamless web. Well, his theology and the media were becoming kind of a seamless web. He says he's merging his Catholicism with the media perceptions. His Catholic perceptions with his media perceptions.
Okay, he writes in his thesis a lot about that, and he talks about Eliot studying theology. McLuhan was a poet who was into theology, but he says his Catholic theologians thought he had not a good grounding in theology, but he was actually questioning their theological assumptions and the media they based their theology on. Now, you said there was another point there.
Well, I want to hear exactly.
Okay, the merging of the study and his faith. You bring them together if you want to say that the visual media of the alphabet and the Catholic faith is what he was about. But they're not bringing up the fact that McLuhan said you are determined by your medium, and if you want to be a Catholic, you've got to use the visual space. But you can't use visual space anymore because it's been usurped. Then how can you be a Catholic? So that's the question McLuhan's raising here. You know, you're limited by the situation today, and then he goes to the point of saying you cannot have ethics under electric conditions. Now, how's a Catholic going to deal with that? Is McLuhan justifying that he's not going to have ethics?
Yeah, but all previous medias always hang around, and like you say, they never go away. So it's still operating. It may be being contextualized in a larger whole, but yeah. the book never went away. The visual media never went away.
Now take that point and vote. media don't go away. We were now coming to a point where maybe the media would go away. That was his question.
But also, by this time, you probably already had the rise of the electronic televangelists.
He was, supposedly, I never experienced it, a favorite among some of the right-wing, or whatever you call them, televangelists, like McLuhan. Mm-hmm. Field told me that. They started to think that he was on their side, which is a contradiction, because they use electronic media to propagate their message. They're probably doing the very thing that I read earlier. That's not the issue, the message. It's what media use. As he says in this Playboy article, mind your media men or you'll catch a cold environment. So let's just go back a bit.
The two would blend, quietly, indirectly, but clearly. In a study of media, he would put forward the perception that our society was built on the effects of visual media. Print-based, beginning with the phonetic alphabet.
Okay, let's stop there. If they mean our society, our Western society is built on visual media, that's true. And then they kind of, then he'll go into the phonetic alphabet. So he's showing how our society had a visual bias. Let's see where he takes this, how far he goes with it.
Perceived the historical development of his own church under these
back.
Same criteria.
You've got to hear every word.
Study of media, he would put forward the perception that our society was built on the effects of visual media, print-based. Beginning with the phonetic alphabet. He would in turn perceive the historic...
Not print-based. Written-based, papyrus-based, the phonetic alphabet. Unless he's saying our industrial society is built on print-based. And that's true. That was a radical change. The medieval world's not the same as the post-print-based world. But the church is built on something before the printing press. Remember, the printing press caused a problem for the church because it created the Protestant faith. So, sloppy statement. Let's go back.
So you don't think the Catholic Church was mutated by the printing press?
It was. It had to deal with a new enemy. And then it changed and became, McLuhan says, more bureaucratic. It merged with the pure print effect, and I guess you could say Rome became more powerful because it was the head of the centralized bureaucracy, which print created. He talks about it in the Blue Book.
With the phonetic alphabet.
It's just want you to hear that sentence. Go back. Always go back a bit further. Okay.
The two would blend, quietly, indirectly, but clearly. In a study of media, he would put forward the perception that our society was built on the effects of visual media. Print-based, beginning with the phonetic alphabet. He would in turn perceive the historical development of his own church under these same criteria.
Psychic effects of TV are no more necessary than the physical effects of polluted drinking water. As long as people persist in ignoring the subliminal and hidden effects of media on psyche and society, they will attribute these things to the will of God.
I would say his faith was actually provided the foundations of his work. You wouldn't necessarily see the evidence of his faith in, you know, the what he called the percepts. In other words, concepts that were more like percepts in the sense that were based on perception rather than some kind of abstract conclusion.
Well, concepts are based on the visual space and the alphabet, and percepts are based on the pattern recognition.
Yeah, now, he's technically wrong from a precise way of saying, but he was saying that the concepts, Western people would hear McLuhan talk and think he was offering ideas and concepts, and he keeps saying, no, I'm offering percepts. So Philip is kind of accurate when he says that he would present concepts as percepts. Two, he was trying to do that, but he's up against society that saw them as concepts. So we'll let him ride on that, but just go back and re-listen to it with that in mind. It's sloppy again.
I would say his faith was actually provided the foundations of his work. You wouldn't necessarily see the evidence of his faith in, you know, the what he called the percepts. In other words, concepts that were more like percepts in the sense that were based on perception rather than some kind of abstract conclusion.
There's a big difference between faith and belief. And these things are very often conflated and regarded as one and the same. To say I have the faith means I believe this or that. And my father's understanding was quite different. faith is not an intellectual act. Believing something is, having an opinion is, but having faith is more like being able to hear or smell. It's a way of knowing.
Well, that's a cool statement. I like that.
Yeah. Faith is probing. Faith is,
sounds like what he means is faith. He sounds like he's talking about faith like gnosis or knowledge of the logos or something.
When McLuhan would say to people, we don't need a point of view. We live in a multi-sensuous, non-visual situation. He then would say that's because we're under TV conditions. But you could say that actually his subplot was, if you want to be a true Christian, you can't work with concepts, which are beliefs. You must work with percepts, which is faith, right?
No, I think faith transcends percepts, and this is what he's saying.
Transcends percepts?
Yeah.
Well, how could that be?
Well, percepts may... Faith is a... earlier they said that he was very intuitive. So faith would be some tapping into some knowledge which gives rise to percepts or perceptual realization, possibly.
Okay.
I think it's more fundamental than the percepts.
All right, but I'll correct that. You've missed the point. He's talking about people, Eric says, they confuse faith and belief. And belief is opinions and concepts. But the section is called faith and perception. Perception's more aligned to the faith side than the belief side.
Yeah, and I would say that faith is primary, can give rise to or sculpt perception, and then you form opinions and beliefs.
Right, but percepts, what is faith if it's not embedded in the senses? How could you have faith without perception?
I don't know that it is embedded in the senses.
Yeah, well, where is it if it isn't?
Well, you know, I mean, if it's possible to know God on any level, then it could be coming through this...
What's it? The nothing coming through?
Well, it's some faculty that gives illumination to perception, but is not perception.
You wouldn't be able to define it.
What's the private citadel of consciousness is not perception.
Oh, yeah, that's perception. But you may not think it's just this sensory perception. It includes other sensory, subtle body perceptions.
Right.
The thing is...
See, like, for instance, I'm looking at the work of a yogi-type guy called Nisargadatta, and he wrote a book called I Am That, and he kept insisting that the nervous system gives rise to perception. First, it gives rise to... nervous system first gives rise to the sense of self, and then the sense of self, you on another level, acquires perception, and then develops opinions and so on. But that fundamental truth transcends even the sense of
the truth or the fundamental truth, which is
fundamental. There's a reality transcending the nervous system. The nervous system becomes a conduit for that.
Well, that's
reality.
The astral body. Okay, yeah. There's other subtle perceptions.
It's not even astral body. It's non-phenomenal. It's hard to talk about. How do you talk about non-phenomenal?
You mean beyond this sensory
world?
Beyond this sensory world.
Yeah.
So even if you're on the astral plane, it's beyond the sensory subtleness of the astral plane, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the void.
Yeah.
Right? The emptiness of all being.
Empty,
yeah, that's
fullness.
Nothing. So why would you need faith dealing with that? That just is.
Well, I don't know.
All right. So I'm saying you might get what they're going to say for a while here, that faith is like he says, come in, no concepts in the church, no coming in the church. You've got to come in on your knees. You've got to see signs or see something, which would be the interplay of the senses. And pattern recognition might be faith, the result of pattern recognition. So I think it comes out of the percepts.
Maybe. One of the things he
anyways,
said about,
that's a typical,
that he derived from Chesterton was Chesterton had this absolute sense of certainty. you know, it was unshakable. He knew something that was so real that everybody's perceptions and opinions and beliefs and so on were superfluous relative to this
right.
certainty.
And he said that the communication of that to people had to be changed, because the old ways of communicating this esoteric, mystical certainty were not, they were speech-based. We're in a new situation. We must communicate it via television or the solar theater, the global theater interplay. What, how's that relate to the communication? So it's a communication problem. Mm-hmm. He said communication of the new is a miracle. Most people say, oh, that's pretty impossible, a miracle. And then he says, but not impossible. So he felt he could communicate the new, but it was an issue of how to communicate the eternal wisdom, if we agree that that's what they're talking about, the eternal private void. But I think that McLuhan, my take on that is that McLuhan saw that the void consciousness didn't work anymore if the media were going to embed in us, supersede us. So with that question in mind, re-listen to that. I think for the purpose of this thing, you'll see that faith is percept and belief is concepts. And I don't see how that relates to the Logos. You're defining the Logos as Gnostic or some kind of no place. That's not the Christian theology.
I think of it as is the wisdom that emanates from the first source or God.
And you know the people that talk, that are called Gnostics, the Catholics will have no truck. I sent you that the review of that Philip Marchand, the guy talking about McLuhan's faith there, his review of Bruce Powell, you know, I'm a heavy McLuhanite, his book on Trudeau. Did you read it? I sent it around a few days ago. And it discusses whether McLuhan and Trudeau are Gnostics or Catholics or what. But the tradition, and Marchand is saying himself as a Catholic, is will not accept that in the Gnostic theology, which I know you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan may have been pushing and including that now. Now that since they both Catholic and Gnosticism were obsolete under these new conditions. So you could say, yes, he's including my religious theological bias, but don't just say that's the end all. Neither are. Both are erased, the Catholic and the Gnostic. That's the question. He says, hey, this is going into a situation like Christian Murray says, they're going to scoop our brains out. Okay, so can we go back?
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, will,
I need to go back.
There's a big difference between faith.
Can I just
belief.
Go back to the where it goes, faith and perception, just to show you. You don't have. We don't have to listen to all this. See, faith and perception, not faith and belief. But then you can go forward. You wanted just to pass through this.
Yeah, but it's not saying faith is perception.
No.
It's saying faith and perception.
But in the discussion, Eric, is that's Eric, not McLuhan, but as Eric's saying, there's faith and belief. That's the dialectic. That's why
I'm saying. Effects of TV are no more necessary than the physical effects of polluted drinking water. As long as people persist in ignoring the subliminal and hidden effects of media on psyche and society, they will attribute these things to the will of God.
Not the real will of God.
I would say his faith was actually provided the foundations of his work. You wouldn't necessarily see the evidence of his faith in, you know, the what he called the percepts. In other words, concepts that were more like percepts in the sense that it were based.
You wouldn't see his faith in his percepts or.
See, yeah, and then, but what were his percepts?
Well,
they were his books, which are conceptual.
Yeah.
And he emphasized that he was not talking about a theory of consciousness. He was talking about relationships. Objects are unobservable. Right. So he knew that when you read a book, you naturally, due to the alphabetic effect, translate into concepts. Like Finnegan's Wake. There's no concepts in Finnegan's Wake because he's trying to show the percept of the book. Right. So watch what he follows up with. He says, he's being lazy, saying he's presenting percepts, and then he goes, concepts become percepts. If you follow what I'm saying, you'll see that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah. But I think his faith is distilled down to something that transcends information. He says the white light.
Trans, what kind of information?
The light no, in I a bulb.
McLuhan wrote against the white light. You know that in the letters.
No.
You got to read. He says the left wing is a product of the Puritan obsession with the white light. the inner light. He makes fun of that all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he definitely, in certain parts of his letters and writings, puts down the Gnostic... because visual space extended the white light and made it a secular fucking hypnosis.
Yeah. He does say that the light is a medium, but the light carries no information.
Yeah.
So there's no...
The tactile light, not a visual light.
Right. So there's no...
It's not an inner light. Right. The Protestant Puritan thinks it's an inner light.
The tactility, there's no perception there.
Yeah.
It's the thing that assembles the perception.
Yeah, that's right. So it's neither inner or outer. It's in between. But the Buddhists and the Gnostics say go inner. It's only going in one direction. The Catholic says this external world is the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah. Well, the best Buddhists say that the higher state of nirvana... There's the states of nirvana that are inward, but the higher states of nirvana...
Are here.
Eyes open, walking around.
Yeah. Okay, so that's done. You could say the higher Buddhists, the higher Sufis, the higher Catholics, the higher Protestants all agree on that. But how do you communicate it? Because you got to use words to somebody, so you start saying this and you lead them that way, but you're trying to get them to the tactile no place. Then television extends the tactile no place.
You know, first there's a mountain, then there is no mountain with the inner realization, then there's a mountain.
Right. Now, different religions communicate this wisdom, if it is true, but those means of communication are obsolete now. That's McLuhan's question, probe, and challenge.
Yeah. It means no division between spirit and flesh.
Yep. So, print, which the Catholic Church is built on, frustrates that perception because it splits the inner and the outer.
Right. I've heard a couple of yogis recently say that in the higher states of nirvana, the body consciousness is almost obliterated. You're so deeply entrenched in the bliss and the power of these higher states that, I mean, anything can happen to the body and it would hardly be noticed. The body becomes...
granted, Scott. Then they come back to communicate it, and they got to deal with the fact they're talking about a astral body or chemical body. What about the TV body and chip body, which confuses the communication of whatever they're saying about the chemical body?
Mm-hmm.
We could assume they're saying the chemical body is lost in consciousness when you move into the higher states of astral nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
But when you come back, you're not coming back just to a chemical body anymore.
Mm-hmm.
One could say, yes, the chip body and the TV body are around the sensory apparatus of the chemical body, and when you leave the chemical body, you're leaving the chip body and the TV body. Yes, you're going somewhere else, but you come back with the insight, and then you're up against a whole new communication problem.
Maybe McLuhan is the only one that this aphorism that I'm about to say applies to, which is, first there is a television and a chip body, then there is no television and a chip body, then there is a television and a chip body.
Yeah, and that's better than using first nature imagery of mountain than that. First there is a mountain.
But the mountain's 25% of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Like,
so the new thing is, first there is a mountain, an astral chakras, and a TV body and a chemical body. Then there's neither all four. Then there is all four, right?
Right. Well, see, that was one of the things that I was deliberating about when we had our company here. What was the man's name? Was it Mark?
Mark, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Mark was saying, no, I don't buy it because there is oil. Oil is associated with energy. Oil and energy are associated with food on my plate. That's physical, and there's no way around it. And then you go, oh, no, and you say, look about the, you know, you're obliterated and discarnate and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is that you tend to get the person to think that it's an all-or-nothing kind of thing. No, he's at least 25% right when he says that the oil...
And that's not enough. It should be at least 50%, so he's got to include the other three.
Yeah.
Even to be in the game.
Yeah, but you always come on to people and say, oh, no, that doesn't have anything to do with it. What it has to do with it is that you're discarnate. And then the person goes, no, I refuse to
agree with you. Give up, I'm 25% solid.
I'm at least 25% solid.
Well, that's why I think I'm being like McLuhan, being a violent communicator, saying things that aren't necessarily so, but you got to get attention, you got to get them going, usually they resist it. but you can't get them thinking in any other way. You can't get them subtle. If you politely suggested that they're tumble 25%,
you could say, no, that's just 25%. What about this part?
Yeah, then they go, what is the other 75%? Then you describe it and go, well, what's that?
Yeah.
And then you might say television and computer. He says, well, that's stuff. I watch TV a couple times a week. I don't even have a computer. Yeah, but you're in an economy that's based on it, which determines how you're going to get your food. So you have to really make it important that it's more than they think, just having the fact they don't watch TV. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Then you got to explain all that. Then you might get them if you do it nice and gentle, and then probably it wouldn't work because you're not being forceful enough or making. You see, if they say that it's not important, the TV part, mm-hmm. what am I supposed to do? So, oh yeah, you're right. Oh yeah, that's. Okay, are you willing to listen and reason for another half hour? No, I don't have time. Okay, I'll give you the punchline. You are not here. You know, you have to leap and you have to exaggerate. Mm. So it's a communication problem. Mm. Now remember what they say with the Zen guys. They beat the guy over the head. Verbally beaten over the head. Isn't that a way of waking people up? Yeah. I got a whole tradition supporting my modern way of beating them over the head with a stick.
Right.
I'm assuming I have something to tell them.
Right.
So let's just go back a bit.
Okay.
That's a picture about 1951. Mechanical.